You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast featuring some of Indiana's most fascinating men and women whose impact has shaped our state, our communities, and us. Join us as we discuss their imprint on our history. Leaders and Legends is brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated, your local veteran business enterprise specializing in public relations, media relations, public outreach, crisis communications, and digital photography. My name is Robert Bain, Principal of Veteran Strategies, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, and Communications Director for the Indiana Republican Party. I'm honored to be your host for our discussion. You're listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies Incorporated and sponsored by the Girl Scouts of Central Indiana and our friend Aaron Shaler, a mortgage broker with Grandview Lending. We're here today with three people who are very close. We're very close with the recently departed Indiana legend and longtime Senator Birch Bayh. A few weeks ago, we posted a podcast that was a Lugar retrospective. So today we pay tribute to one of the true giants of Indiana politics and government. And we're going to go through and let our guests introduce themselves, starting with
Nancy Pappas.
And what's your association? Just very quickly, when did you meet the senator? Did you work for him?
I started working for him in 1965 as a summer intern. And then after I graduated from college in 67, I went to work for him full time in Washington and came back for the 68 campaign. And between 68 and 74, became the office manager, but went off the payroll in campaign years to do campaign work for him.
That's a common occurrence.
Yeah.
Bob? My name is Bob Blamier. I started volunteering for the senator as a freshman in college at George Washington University. In fact, the first person I saw in the office was Nancy Pappas.
Oh, really?
Yep, and I bounced around, did a lot of tasks, eventually drove the senator. That's when we first started getting close, and later became his office manager. I traveled the campaign with him in 1974. I ended up being his political director for the last 3 years he was in office. And I recently published his biography from Indiana University Press, just released it on May 1st.
Oh, congratulations, congratulations. And I believe, I hate to say this, is Senator Louis Mahern our first two-time guest? So, famous two-timer, Louis Mahern is up next.
I like it. Yeah, I'm Louis Mahern. Interaction I had with Birch Bayh was I was about 2 days past 21 when I voted for him absentee from the field when I was in the Marines in 1962. I first met Birch Bayh, I guess maybe in the mid-1960s. I had been elected a precinct committeeman in 66. And then I was on Andy Jacobs' staff from 68 until 72 when he lost to Bill Hudnut. And then I went, it was in D.C., and I went from the House side to the Senate side, and then was on Senator Bayh's staff until March of 76.
Bob, let's start with none of us ever forgot when he joined us.
Since you wrote the biography, let's take a few minutes, Bob, talk about Birch Bayh as a kid, as a college student. What drove him to public service?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, he was born in Terre Haute and grew up with a father who was very much involved in public education. He was also a basketball referee and refereed more high school championship basketball games than anyone in our history.
Really?
When Birch was 10, 11, 12 years old, his father got hired by the Washington, D.C. public school system to run their sports. And they moved to Washington. When he was 12, his mother passed away. And so his father moved Birch and his sister and himself back to Shirkeyville to live with the grandparents and on their farm in Shirkeyville. And his father went into the service. And so he grew up really on the farm and learned to love farming. There was a close friend of his father's who took him sort of under his wing, like a mentor, a guy by the name of Jake Mailing, who ended up taking Birch to see Purdue, taking him to see his fraternity, ATO, and Birch ended up going to Purdue and becoming an ATO. He was active in 4-H and a lot of organizations.
That were typical back then. They were very popular, very, very much a mentoring.
There was no politics in their life, though. None. I mean, it was that came later, really.
And what was his first political gig?
Well, he ran for president of ATO. I knew that, and was the only one elected for 2 years, as at least he told me, whether it's true or not, I don't know. You know, president of a senior class. I mean, he was very active in student politics, both high school and college. He did some pretty remarkable things when he was in the service. Post-World War II, went to Germany and ended up, you know, there was a lot of starvation going on in post-war Germany.
That's right.
And he ended up getting seeds sent over from Indiana and teaching people how to grow vegetables. An article that got featured in Reader's Digest at the time called GI Ambassador, and he got a lot of notoriety for that while at Purdue.
What do you think drove him to run for public office?
I think he had a commitment to public service. When he met his wife, Marvella, she was probably more driven along those lines than he was. And a lot of people I've interviewed over these years have said if it had been a different era, she very well might have been the senator instead of him.
And it's not uncommon for the wives or the spouses to really push, like, run, you can do it.
Guy Jake Maley I mentioned to you, his brother was the minority leader in the House, the Indiana General Assembly, also from Terre Haute. And so they ran in 3-member districts. And Birch had a good reputation. His father had a wide reputation, and everyone liked the Colonel By. And so Birch agreed to run in a 3-member district with Mailing in Terre Haute for the state legislature.
Did he enjoy his time in the Indiana General Assembly?
He loved it. Loved it. Talks about it in glowing terms. Tells great stories from the legislature. Said he sort of feels like he learned everything that he took with him later.
So let's jump ahead. Obviously, there's a lot to cover, and we want to get everyone involved, but it's 1962. He decides to run against a 3-term Republican senator whose name is?
Homer Capehart.
And it's funny, too, because in the movie 13 Days, the race is mentioned. By's got no chance, or By's going to lose, or something like that. It was a pretty good Democratic year coming off the Cuban Missile Crisis that was happening almost concurrent with the election. But it was a very famous and a very close election. And I don't know if I have my history exactly right, but I think it's the 2-vote-per-precinct election or something like that. Bob, talk about that, then Louis, jump in.
Yeah, he would be the first to acknowledge that if the Cuban Missile Crisis hadn't turned out the way it did, he wouldn't have won. When he said when Black Monday came and the announcement of the missiles in Cuba, they felt it was over. Capehart had been calling for an invasion of Cuba long before they knew about the missile crisis. And so there was a lot of confidence that Capehart could coast to victory. And Birch said he owed it to a lot of people who stood by him and wanted to make sure that they continued to raise money, continued to get him on television. They bought time for half-hour telethons where he would just talk live to callers. And it had never really been done here before. And he kept campaigning in that manner and ended up winning by 10,000 votes, which is really just a little bit more than 1 vote per precinct.
Louis, were you someone who was drawn to him because of that election, that a Democrat could unseat someone who was a very popular, very important Republican senator for 18 years?
Well, I was in the Marines when he was elected the first time in 1962. I can remember my mom writing letters to me about Birch Bayh and how exciting the election was and all that. And then I think it was maybe just he gets elected in 62. And then in 63, I think it was, whenever his birthday was, they had a big fundraiser at the Cadle Tabernacle, which was a venue here in downtown Indianapolis. It's no longer there. And they were passing out recordings, or my parents purchased a recording or something like that, of Hey, Look Him Over. You know, his theme song, and they
the
sent
good old
it,
days, man.
And they mailed it to me, but there was nobody. By this time, I was overseas, and there was absolutely nobody in my platoon who had a 45 record player. And so, I don't think I got to listen to that thing until I was discharged.
Nancy, what drew you to him? We were saying off air. My mother was born here, and then my mother went in the Marine Corps. She was the first Marine Corps recruit in Indianapolis, a female, after World War II. And I remember being a little kid, and she just worshipped, just thought he was the beau ideal of a public servant. Is that, what was it that made you think, this is a guy I want to work both with and for?
Well, in that era, when Jack Kennedy got elected, there was a generational change at the highest level of our government. And Jack Kennedy asked everybody, ask not what you can do for your country, but what you, or ask what you can do for your country. And that inspired so many young people. Here was somebody they could identify with, was closer to their age. My parents were young Democrats and worked very hard for Birch Bayh in Hamilton County, which was at least as Republican then as it is now. And they won their precinct by two votes for Birch Bayh. And we all worked very hard, went door to door and passed out flyers and raised money and went to the airport rally that Jack Kennedy came in for Birch Bayh. And so young people responded, and I was one of those. My parents said Birch Bayh and Marvella were the Jack and Jackie Kennedy of Indiana.
And I'd heard that before.
Yes.
Yeah, you read stuff around that era, and the word Kennedy-esque keeps getting printed over and over. Well, remember, Homer Capehart was an overweight, elderly politician who wore white suits. I mean, he looked like a caricature in many ways.
And smoked cigars.
And the man Kennedy hated the most among his colleagues in the Senate when he served in the Senate.
Yeah, because Kennedy and Nixon were good friends when they were both in the Senate. But let me ask a quick question about one Kennedy, and then I'm going to ask a quick question about another Kennedy. Did President Kennedy recognize the leadership qualities, the incredible intelligence and charisma of Birch Bayh after he got in the Senate? I mean, did they continue to be two people who would work together? Obviously, Kennedy gets killed November 22nd of 63, so they're not in D.C. at the same time.
Well, they were for 11 months.
Yeah.
Birch was a senator for 11 months by the time Kennedy.
Yeah, but they were. My point was, it's not like they worked together for years. But did they have that connection when Senator Bayh came in?
They had Kennedy's a lot of interaction. They watched movies at the White House with the Kennedys. They went to dinner with them. So there was an interaction. I think that he was very much of that whole image and generation that John Kennedy represented. And so I think he did fit in. Plus, he became friendly quickly with Bobby and with Teddy. So there was that camaraderie. But yeah, Marvella, in her book, Marvella Bayh writes a lot about the parties at the White House and watching the movies together.
I believe it. I think the last movie Kennedy watched before he died is, that's a great trivia question, I'm pretty sure it's From Russia with Love.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he suggested to the British filmmakers, they asked him what his favorite Bond book was, and he said From Russia with Love, and so they made that the second Bond movie after Dr. No. At least that's the question I ask at the Golden Ace, and nobody complains when
Jack,
I do trivia.
You know, Ian Fleming in the whole Bond series got a big bump out of when it became known that John Kennedy read those
fan.
Books. Was a big fan of the Bond series.
Speaking of Kennedys, it's a few years later. Is it 64 or 65? Is it 64? 1964.
June.
It's also another trivia question I asked at the Golden Ace, if the McGinleys are listening. And that is, Senator Birch Bayh saves the life of Senator Ted Kennedy after a plane crash, literally pulls him out of a burning plane or a plane that had crashed, but significant injuries to Kennedy. Bob, why don't you, since you wrote the book, talk about it.
I have to tell you, my interesting perspective on that is I used to fly a lot with him. And I would joke with him, what are the odds that you're going to go down twice? So there are, and he would talk about the plane crash, but I never got the detail I got from him until I interviewed him for the book on this subject. And it was fascinating because Ted Kennedy writes a lot about it in his memoirs, and there's differences between the two. And we talked about that. But one of the most poignant things that came out of the interviews was when he said when they got back to the hospital, he called Bobby. And he said, I have some bad news. Ted and I were in a plane crash. And Bobby's response was, did I lose him too? Which I had never heard prior to that.
Where are they flying? Kind of what's the circumstance?
Birch was keynoting the Democratic State Convention in Massachusetts in Springfield, and it was for Ted Kennedy to serve a full term. He'd finished the unexpired term of his brother.
Right.
And so Birch was going to keynote the convention, but that same day, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, and it didn't get passed until well into the evening. So the plane that had gone earlier with the families, they needed a second plane to come in and get the senators. And Marvella decided to stick around and fly with her husband. So it was Marvella and Birch Bayh, Ted Kennedy, his chief of staff, Eddie Moss, and the pilot. Moss and the pilot died in the crash.
Did that maybe this is a crazy question, but I mean, I would assume that probably fortified some sort of bond between Teddy Kennedy and Birch Bayh. because he broke his back. Didn't Ted Kennedy
broke his back? Yeah.
He had significant injuries.
Yeah, and in fact, there are books that Bob Schrum, a consultant, for instance, wrote about it. How no matter what happened between when Kennedy was visiting Indiana, if people were upset with Birch Bayh because he wasn't endorsing Kennedy or whatever, he said Kennedy always gave him a pass. As far as Kennedy was concerned, Birch had a pass. And Joan Kennedy used to come out all the time for campaigns, and she would say the same thing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Did Birch Bayh get pretty close with Robert Kennedy? And where did Senator Bayh stand in the 1968 election? Nancy, you were there.
Yes. Well, we had strict instructions on the staff to not take sides in that primary at all.
Remember, Birch was up.
He runs against Ruckelshaus, as I recall.
Yes. You had favorite sons in standing in for President Johnson, and he had friends, and you know he was close to the Johnson family and to President Johnson and to the Kennedys as well. So it just was, you know, stay completely out of it.
You want to read a great book on that election? I mean, there are several, but The Year the Dream Died by Jules Witkover takes you through the whole thing about how Robert Kennedy felt guilty that McCarthy beat him to being the anti-war candidate. What was it like to be involved with the senator and be in D.C. just like during that time? I mean, these are heady times. Assassination in 63, Civil Rights Act in 64, Voting Rights Act, I think, in 65. Lyndon Johnson shellacks Barry Goldwater in 1964 in an absolute landslide. 66, the Republicans have this amazing year in the midterms. Now you come to 68. It's the year that everyone talks about all this political and social turmoil. Louis, what was it like to be around at that time, involved in politics?
I was very deeply involved in the Robert Kennedy campaign. I went to the airport with Mike Riley. When we picked up the first person to come in, a guy by the name of Gerard Doherty, who was the former Democratic state chairman in Massachusetts, and I was the guy who went over to the printing company and got the petitions printed up for Robert Kennedy to be on the ballot, and recruited people from around the state to circulate the petitions. So I was very deeply involved in that primary. And then I recall very well after Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, we still had the election in the fall when Birch Bayh was running against Bill Ruckelshaus. I mean, it
another
was,
squeaker.
Yeah. And then that was also the year when there was, as it was defined later, the police riot in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention. And, of course, the assassination, not only of Robert Kennedy, but of Martin Luther King. I can remember years later when I was in the state Senate and interns would ask me, oh, man, 1968, you know, that must have been really exciting. What was that like? And I told them it was horrible.
And how did Senator Bayh navigate all of these issues and controversies and battles, Bob?
Well, you know, I think that's probably a big question about his whole career because he was never afraid to deal with issues. And I think what made us proud to work for him is the way he stood his ground on issues that were very unpopular. Whether it was when Lieutenant Calley had the massacre at My Lai, and Birch was the first one to step forward and suggest that the process needed to move forward properly, and when Nixon was sort of pushing his thumb on the scale, or things like, you know, whether it was abortion or guns or busing or the various
prayer
things.
Prayer in schools.
There was a lot. 68, I'm not able to talk about experiences with Birch too much in 68 because I was still a freshman in college. But I was able to meet Robert Kennedy that year, to me, which was totally exciting.
And when he was here in April?
No, in Washington at an event at GW, my college. And then went to his announcement in the Senate caucus room. Yeah. And then when Martin Luther King was assassinated and there was Easter break, I got a flight out of Washington and flew over 14th Street when it was on fire. And then we were landing in Chicago. Chicago was on fire. So you felt like the world was coming apart, it seems.
Right.
But yeah, it was a tough year. It was an amazing year.
Let's talk a little bit. Nancy, I want to ask you, because it goes right to what Bob just said. Much like Senator Lugar, when we did his podcast, Senator Lugar was not afraid to take on the big issues. Neither was Senator Birch Bayh. What was it like to see him at work when he was fighting for civil rights, lowering the voting age to 18, fighting for the ERA, trying to get rid of the Electoral College, doing the presidential disability, Title IX? I mean, these are significant whatever you feel about them one way or the other. I mean, you can't deny their gravitas. What was it like to see him work on really important things?
He was an amazing person. He always aspired to excellence. He pushed himself. He was part of the reason he survived the presidential year in 1968. Nixon was very popular in Indiana. He was just great at retail politics. Lee Hamilton probably paid Birch Bayh one of the best compliments. He said he had the best people skills of anybody I had ever met. So he was just a workaholic in that sense. On the campaign trail, he would be at plant gates at 5:30 in the morning, and he'd go until 12, 1 o'clock at night, and he would do that for days and days and days on end, and he'd wear out staff members in the process, and we'd have to rotate through, but he was doing it all the time. And he approached legislation the same way. He just never gave up, but he had an uncommon way to relate to people. Most of the Senate, virtually all of the Senate, was much older than he was when he got there, and seniority was the coin of the realm. But he had a wonderful way to take input from all sorts of people. He knew how to explain things in a way that everybody could relate to, and I think that was one of his many gifts.
You know, Robert, when I did the interviews for the book, a recurring theme that I didn't look for but kept coming out in the interviews with staff people throughout this country, all sorts of people, was that when they would bring up the politics of an issue, he would keep telling them, I can determine the politics. I want you to tell me what you think is right. And he kept saying that over and over. And the number of people that said that in their accounts to me was kind of startling, because, yes, I had heard it also. I mean, I just believe he felt in his heart of hearts, you're here to do what you think is right. And hopefully people will support you and return you. If they don't, well, you know, I'll find something else to do.
Let me specifically ask you about Vietnam. I can't recall off the top of my head if he voted for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. I'm assuming he did.
Only since two senators didn't.
Since everybody did, basically. Right. I didn't think he was one of the few who didn't. And this can be to one of you or all of you. You can decide. How did his views on Vietnam evolve?
I will tell you a story that Birch Bayh told me one time when we were driving around. I was driving around, and in 1968, I mean, it's a tough election coming up, and the war looms large, and he had been invited down to the White House by Lyndon Johnson to talk about the campaign and talk about, you know, the race and all that, and he told me, he says, Birch Bayh, or he said, President Johnson told me that if you want to go out there and be critical of me, it's okay. If you want to be critical of the effort in the war, it's okay. I just want you to get reelected.
And it won't affect our friendship.
Yeah, that's right. And then he said that he called in Marvin Watson, who was an assistant to Lyndon Johnson, one of the president's assistants, and he told him, Marvin, he says, I want you to take care of Senator Bayh. If he needs a new bridge, if he needs a post office, whatever it is he needs, you take care of it. And also, Birch Bayh told me that he offered to make Marvella the vice chair of the National Democratic Party, and Birch said that he thought maybe that was a little too much.
I do talk about that in the book. The Marvin Watson story, LBJ, is totally true. He, not only that, he asked for a list of what is important to you. Mm-hmm. And Birch said, we went back to the office and we huddled. We came up with a list of, he said, 8 or 10 bridges, overpasses, crossings, dams, reservoirs, whatever. All of them happened.
Yeah. Well, Lyndon Johnson was a former minority leader, or excuse me, majority leader of the Senate, and knew how things got done and knew how elections won.
But he went to Vietnam. And that's, I think that was one of the big changes. He visited there right before the Tet Offensive.
Senator Bai did.
Yes. He went to with Ted Kennedy, actually. He
and that's
Kennedy
in early 68.
Late 67. Mm-hmm. And they came back just before the Tet Offensive started.
Okay.
And what he found was when you talk to the generals, you got the company line. When you talk to the CIA reporters and the lower level officers out in the field, you got the overwhelming sense that this wasn't going too well.
You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies Incorporated and sponsored by the Girl Scouts of Central Indiana and our friend Aaron Shaler, a mortgage broker with Grandview Lending. We're talking a little bit about the career and life and times of former Indiana Senator Birch Bayh, who passed away a few months ago, just before Senator Richard Lugar did. This is going to ruin this podcast, so I guess I'll say it anyway. I'm a fan of Richard Nixon in a lot of ways. Get the defibrillator out for Mr. Blamire. I think he's not the devil incarnate. He got what he deserved. I make no excuses for him, but some of the things that he accomplished on the domestic side are extremely liberal. And a lot of things he accomplished on foreign policy, even into the 80s, polls showed that Richard Nixon was the most admired president when it came to foreign relations. What did Senator Birch Bayh think of Richard Nixon?
Well, I think he thought he was a fierce competitor when he had to run on the same ticket in 1968. Birch Bayh set a record for ticket splitting that year, people who had voted for Nixon and then crossed over to vote for Birch Bayh. And in Bob's book, he tells the story about when the senator was working on the 25th Amendment. Richard Nixon was the most impressive witness he had about presidential succession, because President Eisenhower had been temporarily disabled 3 different times, I think it was, by heart attacks, and so Richard Nixon had stepped in to take over. But there was a real question about whether some of the things he did would even be legal.
That's exactly right.
Because there was no structure to say this is what you do when you have presidential disability.
Well, correct my history here, but Roosevelt dies in April of 45. Truman becomes president. There's no vice president until 48 when he chooses Alvin Barkley, and then he wins in 48. Eisenhower had a couple of bad heart attacks and a stroke. I think one of the strokes, he's playing golf. So Nixon kind of assumes powers. But to your point, Nancy, that's exactly right. They're like, is this even legal?
You know, they had a written agreement, but there's a lot of people that could question if that went to the court, would it stand up? Because it's not in the Constitution.
And then in 63, Kennedy gets assassinated. Johnson becomes president. You don't have a vice president until Hubert Humphrey gets elected vice president in 64. So there was this real need. What made Birch Bayh take the lead in closing all this drama?
Well, if you remember when Kennedy got shot, there was an open question. Suppose his body had stayed alive he was totally incapacitated. There was nothing in the Constitution that allowed a transfer of power.
In another little piece of trivia, assassinating the president was not a federal crime. So when the Secret Service tried to take his body back to D.C., right, the Texas cops wouldn't let him because they said Texas law says there must perform an autopsy before they leave the jurisdiction. And the Secret Service people basically take out their guns and say,
they took him anyway.
We're taking the president home. Anyway, sorry, forgive me. Go ahead.
No, so it seemed like this was an incredible gap. Not only that, there had been several vacancies. I think 8 times there had been lengthy periods without a vice president. Mm-hmm. And so it just seemed logical. Number one, he had just gotten his first subcommittee chairmanship, the subcommittee in constitutional amendments. And there had been proposals, and this became his mantra. He went after that. Think about this. We have a first-term senator that before his first term is up, he's passed a constitutional amendment. There have been 11,000 attempts to end the Constitution in our history. Only 17 since the Bill of Rights have passed. He has 2 of them.
And he would have had three had the ERA passed.
Or four if direct election had passed.
Yeah, you know, right. I mean, and ERA came very close. I mean, yes. I mean,
Lackawanna State.
You don't think about it now, Nancy, because it just times are different, and you can argue whether it's needed or not needed. That's not the point of us being here. But the ERA was a huge issue in the 70s. What was it like to work for the senator who's trying to do all he can to make that happen?
Yeah, I was so proud of him for doing that. When I first came to Washington, D.C. to work for him, I was surprised and almost stunned at the women who were in managerial positions in his office. And then it was sometime later that I'd heard that I didn't call him Colonel Bai, I called him Daddy Bai, had made Birch Bai a feminist, because when Birch Bai was young, his dad said he was going to Capitol Hill to testify, you know, that girls ought to have equal sports opportunities with young men. And so he'd always been so out there on women's rights. And I had worked in his Senate office, and then by the time ERA came to the states, I was a lobbyist for the Indiana State Teachers Association, which was very supportive of the Equal Rights Amendment. And it took us several years to get it passed in the state of Indiana, and it was very difficult and stunning, because people in the legislature that Birch Bai had served with, Democrats who he was very close to, just could not abide women having equal rights. They were on a pedestal. You're going to lose more rights than you're ever going to gain. And do we really want to do this? And it was difficult to get over that hump.
And how important was Marvella Bai in that same fight, in buttressing what Senator Bai was doing?
Well, she'd been denied an opportunity to get into the University of Virginia because she was a woman, and they told her it was because she was a woman. And I think
when
that
was this the 40s?
Oh no! It would be later in the 50s, probably. 50s?
Yeah, University of Virginia. She was all male.
Yeah, and she went to go to graduate school there. She always felt that that's just unfair. They take federal money, and yet they treat men in different and women so differently.
Correct me my history again. Isn't that where Evan Bai?
Went to law school there.
Went to law school there. Well, that's a nice little piece of revenge.
Yes, yes.
You wouldn't let my mother
and this
in.
This is the school established by Jefferson and Madison. I mean, some of the great founders, right. And mm-hmm. yet it was male only.
Of all the things that Senator Bai accomplished, the one that's most pervasive in modern culture is Title IX. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that, too.
Yes. Bob's got a better record in his book of how that happened, but it has made such a phenomenal difference in our culture. Girls and women were like 9% and 7%, I think, of law schools and medical schools when Title IX passed, and now they comprise the majority of college enrollment across the country, and that's made a big difference in what their opportunities have been then ever since then.
Let me ask you,
about sports. It wasn't about sports. It was about educational institutions must treat men and women the same. But on the sports front, when it passed, there were 250,000 women and girls involved in high school or collegiate sports in 1972. 10 years later, it was 3 million.
Think how many gold medals, Olympic gold medals, were won by women. Female American athletes because of Title IX.
That's a terrific point. Before we move on, when we get to 74, I hate to ask this question, but did any of you ever talk, speaking of presidential succession, get a comment from Birch Bai about Alexander Haig's quote that I'm in charge here? We have the Constitution, gentlemen. I'm in charge here. The famous quote by the Secretary of State after Reagan was shot on March 30th, 1981.
He would say something along the lines of, he's wrong, you know.
I think Haig's problem was not only, I mean, he was a 4-star general and former chief of staff to Nixon, so I understand what he was trying to do, but it's just when he asserted, what you have here is the Constitution, gentlemen.
I'll tell you what I find fascinating about 25th Amendment. I wrote it early in the book because it just fascinated me. When those of us who were aware of Watergate and what went on, if you can remember it, the House was passing in bills of impeachment, and a bunch of senators went down to the White House to tell Nixon, basically, you've lost, you got to go. If there hadn't been the vice presidency filled by Gerald Ford at that point, because Agnew had resigned in disgrace, and under the 25th Amendment, 7 years old at the time, Gerald Ford becomes vice president. If he wasn't there, the presidency would have passed to the Democratic Speaker of the House.
Isn't that Carl Albert?
Yes. What are the chances that these senators would have told Nixon he had to step aside if he was turning over the administration to the Democrats?
And Nixon thought that Agnew was his Trump card.
Right.
They'll never impeach me because they don't want this nutcase Agnew to be president of the United States.
Yeah, he didn't know he was a crook, too.
Speaking of Jules Witkover, if you want to read a fascinating book on that relationship, it's called Strange Bedfellows, and it's a book about the relationship between Nixon and Agnew. And it's unfathomable in today's society with media and as it is that Agnew could have been vice president. They never spoke. After Agnew left, said, I'm quitting over corruption charges, Nixon never talked to him again. And here he was a heartbeat away from the presidency. Here at Leaders and Legends, we're talking about Senator Birch Bayh's career with Nancy Pappas, Bob Blamire, and our good friend Louis Mahern. In 1974, it's called the Watergate year for Democrats. They wipe out swaths of Republican elected officials throughout the country. But in 1974, Birch Bayh runs again, and he runs against Richard Lugar. When I read about that election, it's one of those, it's a shame one of them has to lose elections. And it was another squeaker. It was very close, even in a Democrat year. What was it like to be around Birch Bayh then and that election? And did he feel like any remorse isn't the right term, but maybe chagrin that he has to beat Lugar of all people?
Oh, no.
I tell a story about
he's a pretty competitive dude.
Yeah.
winning is pretty important. Yeah.
Marvella Bayh was back here campaigning in that 74 campaign, and I was driving her to wherever the campaign event was. And she said, I don't know why Birch always has to get such fantastic opponents. Bill Ruckelshaus was formidable. Richard Lugar is so formidable. And I said, one way to look at it is the Republicans knew they had to come up with a really outstanding candidate because Birch Bayh was going to be so difficult to beat. So it's a really good reflection on him that they've come up with such sterling candidates. She thought about that for a second or two, and she said, I could do with a little less reflection.
Did they have a relationship at all?
At the time, no.
So in 74, Lugar is elected mayor of Indianapolis in 67, and he runs for Senate in 74, as campaign manager, as I recall, by Mitch Daniels. Mm-hmm. And they, even though Bayh was in the Senate and Lugar was the mayor of the largest of the capital, they didn't have any relationship at all?
No, not really. My relationship, that year is pretty unique, and I probably write more about it disproportionately because I traveled with him throughout the campaign. We had 3 days off in 5 months. It was really grueling. And no, there was no real relationship. I mean, we worked as a staff. You always worked with elected officials, particularly of your major municipalities. And so there was that kind of working relationship. Was there a personal relationship? No. Now, did he respect Lugar? Yes. Was he concerned about him? Yes.
Did you know pretty early that he was going to run for Senate?
Yeah. Yeah. And plus, we liked the fact that as Watergate was unfolding, that he had this reputation as Nixon's favorite mayor, which Lugar said to me in my interview with him that really was unfair. It was David Broder had written in an article that he's down in the White House so often, he must be Nixon's favorite mayor.
I think Nixon said it at the Monument Circle.
Yeah, Lugar says later, he's at a ceremony sitting next to Nixon, and he leaned over to him and says, you were my favorite mayor.
Well, I hate to say this, but I wrote about that in The Star.
Oh, did you?
I wrote a column when Richard Lugar passed, and part of the column is about Andy Jacobs and how much they respected each other and liked each other. But right after Greg Ballard's elected, there's an event at Meridian Hills, and Lugar's speaking to like 15 of us, right? It's Jim Morris, Greg Ballard, Teresa Lubbers, Mark Lubbers, kind of a small group of people. And he did a question period, and I just, being an East Sider, you just can't help yourself. And I raised my hand, and I said, Senator, please answer a question for me. Were you Nixon's favorite mayor? And he said that, tells the same story. He goes, years later, Nixon comes to the Capitol for some luncheon or something, And they're sitting next to each other, and Nixon just blurts it out. You know, you really were my favorite mayor.
I think there was an international meeting of mayors, wasn't it, in Indianapolis?
It was a League of Cities happened here. Yeah.
I don't remember that.
In 74, you talked
He knew we beat him over the head with it constantly. I mean, remember, Nixon right now is in the middle of the biggest scandal in American history. Well, so
politically, you should have.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're realists here at Leaders and Legends. You mentioned 62. You don't necessarily think, or Birch Bayh didn't necessarily think he would have won without the Cuban Missile Crisis. In 74, do you beat Richard Lugar without Watergate? In what, a 51-49 election or 52-48?
I think it's doubtful. I mean, well, Lugar said to me, and I expect it's true, that his polling was that we were neck and neck going right up to the Ford pardon.
Oh, the Ford pardon Nixon came, in September of 74.
The bottom fell out for them.
And I think that's possible. And it was the only good Democratic year that Birch Bayh ran in.
Yeah. That's right. Remember, he ran in bad years every time against good candidates.
Except 74.
Well, 62 wasn't the D's had a better than average year for an initial term.
But who would have thunk it? I mean, the reality is that the first year election after the presidential election is bad for the party in power.
Yeah.
Usually, yes, right. Almost in every case,
And if the Cuban Missile Crisis hadn't turned out the way it did and gave Jack Kennedy such a boost in the polls, there were a number of Democrats elected to the Senate who would not have been elected that year had it not been for that missile crisis.
Nancy, what was the temperature of the 74 campaign? Two accomplished people, two military men, very bright. Lugar of 74 isn't the Lugar of, 2012 or whatever year you want to say when he becomes this statesman, for lack of a better term. But I don't necessarily remember that campaign per se in its details, but was it highbrow, lowbrow? How would you say? Was it more negative than positive? I mean, obviously you're crushing him with Nixon. What were Lugar's kind of attack points or pushes against Bayh?
I honestly don't remember. Do you?
Big spender. It was always the big spender.
Right.
Birch Bayh, the big spender.
Yes. The liberal big spender, out of touch with the people of Indiana, over and over and over. That's Nancy and I were talking earlier. There was Birch liked to poke fun at that image, the limousine liberal who's out of touch. And there was a great event in Evansville where both Lugar and Bayh are there. And Birch gives a speech by turning his back to the audience, mussing his hair, turning around and saying, "Oh, shucks." And then he said he was sitting in his cabin with Marvella and Evan, and Marvella was sewing a star on the American flag. And Evan was reading his Boy Scout manual. And I started to walk out of the house, and Marvella said, "Hey, Blue Eyes." She always calls me Blue Eyes. And the crowd was just going crazy. Witkover was there that night, and he wrote.
Jules Witkover.
Yeah, he wrote about them. Richard Lugar had to learn the hard way the mastery of Birch Bayh. I mean, he was able to, in such a welcoming way, poke fun at himself positively.
You never forget your first child, right? For those of us who are parents. So his election in 62 must have just been amazingly satisfying. But do you think in some ways 74 was maybe one that he cherished more because he took on Lugar and won, and now he's poised to do what he's about to do in 76, which is run for president? How does one lead into the other?
I would say no. I think 62 was for him.
His favorite.
I think he looked back on that with such – because, number one, he felt alone in believing he could win. He always has said that I wasn't smart enough to realize I couldn't win.
Right.
And he was able to win. And the song was important. And the missile crisis was probably determinative. So 74 was important and very satisfying. But it was so grueling and exhausting because of Lugar. Look, I was 25 years old and my teeth were falling out. I mean, the amount of lack of rest and lack of good food and this campaign was amazing, but right away people started talking to him about running for president. And for a long time, he just had a hard time deciding because he was so dog tired.
In 1976, the Democrats have a pretty big field, not rivaling what they have now, but they had a strong field with a lot of really good candidates willing to take on Gerald Ford, who had neither been elected president nor vice president, survived a couple of assassination attempts, was suffering because of the pardon of Nixon, which I think is in September of 74. But Ford was a smart politician and was very well respected. What made Birch Bayh think he could A, win the nomination, and then B, beat Gerald Ford? Nancy?
Well, he was very committed to the issues he was committed to. And he'd received a lot of national attention since that first year he was in the Senate. He was able to navigate the Senate and the national press and difficult elections and raise money. He just had a lot of gifts. During that campaign, I was by that time working for the Teachers Association, and he'd asked me to go down to South Carolina to their statewide teachers convention and represent him. And I said, is yours going to be the only campaign represented? He said, oh, no. He said, Jimmy Carter's going to be there, and Walter Mondale's going to be there, and Scoop Jackson's going to be there. I said, and Nancy Pappas? He said, yes. He said you'll do a great job. Well, when we got down there, when I compared all of their records on education, Birch Bayh's was the most outstanding record on education of anybody that was there. And Jimmy Carter was the only Southerner that was there. Right. But I was pleased that, you know, when you laid the facts out there for him, Jimmy Carter did win the straw poll that day, but Birch Bayh came in a strong second because he had a remarkable record for a relatively young senator in the United States Senate. And people, you know, when, you know, they might not have been cognizant of that and have his name on the tip of their tongue, but when you repeated all these things, the heads would start to nod in the audience. So he did have something of a national profile, which I don't think most of us in Indiana really understood. But people had heard of him, and they'd heard of the 25th Amendment.
And if you go back a few years, you have to remember, right after Nixon got elected, Birch took the leadership on two Supreme Court nominees.
Oh,
the
Haynesworth
Senate defeated both.
Carswell.
This has never happened before. Two of them opposed, and both are won, and both are led by the same guy. And we learned a lot about the Nixon people in that process. And he became very much opposed to Richard Nixon philosophically. It had nothing to do with personality. And he actually ended up being very friendly with Gerald Ford. He played in the congressional ball games with Ford. They met together in jock straps in the bowels of the RFK Stadium.
Yeah, Andy Jacobs would tell those stories. He goes, you're always running into these people naked.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And he ended up on Nixon's enemies list. Birch
did end up.
Yes, during Watergate. So there was a great deal of enthusiasm about ending this administration.
But what about, let me ask a question. I'm not necessarily Pavlov in my defense of Nixon, but when it comes to foreign affairs, his record's pretty amazing considering some of the things he accomplished in the context of the Cold War. Was Senator Bayh someone who supported the opening to China, supported the SALT I agreement, and sort of the detente focus on foreign affairs?
My response would be yes, generally. But it was the domestic policies where they separated most, where he thought they were very divisive, sending Agnew around and to really dividing people with these various speeches that Agnew would make. He just developed much more of an opposition than he'd ever had in his political life to an administration. And you can say they were doing good things here, but if you think that the domestic policies are so bad and need to be changed, you try to change them.
You know, people forget right now the bogeyman is immigration and people flooding over the borders and everything like that. Back in the day when Birch Bayh was in the Senate, the bogeymen were prayer in school. We need a constitutional amendment to guarantee prayer in school. We need a constitutional amendment to stop busing, you know, and all those sorts of things. And those were the things that that the Republican Party and Richard Nixon in particular were using to essentially define Democrats. Democrats are against prayer. Democrats are for disrupting your children's education.
He did win 49 states in 1972. Senator Bayh react to that?
Sometimes those tactics pay off.
But how did he react to Nixon's overwhelming landslide in 72? Like incredulous? Like, I can't simply believe it?
No, remember, we had the opening to China. We had the Russian, you know, Nixon going to Russia. McGovern was not a good candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think Birch would be the first one to tell you that. He liked George McGovern a lot, didn't feel that he was a good candidate.
Bomber right pilot. Candidate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of characteristics about him that should have been very positive, but mm-hmm. not the way he allowed himself to be portrayed. So I think that there wasn't a big surprise. Everybody saw it coming.
Louis and Bob, did you guys work on the 76 presidential campaign? And why do you think it didn't really take fire?
I was in the process of running for the state Senate myself, and so I was kind of preoccupied with that. But I did travel one time to Iowa to do some door-to-door.
Because that was the year the Iowa caucuses became the Iowa caucuses.
And they had existed for years.
That's right.
That's what's interesting. In many respects,
they were
Carter,
not a big
suckering
deal.
In Birch Bayh, Mo Udall, Scoop Jackson, Sergeant Shriver into Iowa. If they hadn't gone, Carter's victory in Iowa, which really wasn't a victory, none of the above won. Carter was second. But that gave him the bump for New Hampshire, which wouldn't have existed had the other candidates not gotten in. But there was this opportunity. They got this governor of Georgia who's been running around the state for a year. Mm-hmm. And Birch had organized there previously when he started to run for president, but ended that because his wife got breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And he felt that he was Iowa, you know, mm-hmm. was like Indiana. It was his kind of place. So he wanted to compete there. His problem was he got started very late. We really didn't get started till October of 75.
Yeah, because Carter has no job. I mean, he's done being governor in 74, right. And I mean, he's got his peanut farm, but I mean, Birch Bayh is pretty darn busy.
Yeah, and tired from 74, too. Believe me, that I know very well.
So from 76 or from early 77 until 1980, Richard Lugar and Birch Bayh are Indiana's United States Senators. An incredible gift to Hoosiers. How did they get along and work together? I cannot recall in Indiana history, and I'm sure maybe there's, or in other examples where a junior senator is serving with the senior senator who beat him 2 years earlier. What was that relationship like, Nancy?
I don't know. I was off the staff by that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I was still there. It's happened in Ohio, too. Glenn Metzenbaum had run against each other and ended up.
Oh, that's right.
Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum.
They didn't get along at all. You know, I think we didn't know what to expect when it started. I remember him in December of 76. What do you do after the session's over and you're getting near the holidays? Everybody's dressing casually and you're really cleaning up, putting files away, sending stuff up to the attic. And Birch walks through the office, grabs three or four of us, say, "We're going to go to see Dick Lugar." And I think we all said, "What?" And we went and ended up spending the afternoon sitting, talking with Lugar and the staff. It was our first way of...
And was Mitch Daniels there as chief of staff at
yes,
the time?
Yes, yes. And, you know, the idea was, look, we're both representing Indiana. Let's work together. Their relationship, as time went on, got closer and closer, especially when Birch became the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, and Lugar was on the Intelligence Committee. And he said there were only he needed to be able to have a few of his colleagues he could rely on to share the secrets he was told by the administration. And Lugar was one of the very few that he relied on. And he said, nothing ever leaked. He found he could trust him. And they ended up working together on a lot of things, and I would say that he genuinely liked him. And Lugar introduced the bill to rename the federal building after Birch.
Oh, really?
And don't forget, Birch Bayh was the author of FISA.
Yes.
Well, that's right, the FISA Court, the Federal mm-hmm. Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Let me say this. When Lugar died, the Star ran the picture of Bayh, like, talking into Lugar's ear. That was the committee that investigated Billy Carter.
That's right.
And I was like, what is he telling? I would always want a little, like, let's get this guy or let's get the hell done with it.
Billy Carter is a good example, though. Mm-hmm. None of us wanted him to do that. I mean, remember, he's running for re-election in 1980. And he's dubbed the chair of the Billy Carter Committee, investigating the president's brother while he's supposed to be running for re-election.
So Billy Carter was under investigation for taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from Libya.
From Libya.
And it was called Billy Gate.
Yes.
Which I guess is an improvement over Billy Beer, which is what Billy Carter was marketing. And they were charged with the investigation.
And he was chairing it. And we hated that. I mean, those of us on the staff, first of all, you don't want him out of the state. You want him in the state every day. And this is what, again, I give him plaudits. He's felt, you know, somebody's got to do it. It's my job. And he stepped up and he did it. And it was a sacrifice.
We talked a little bit earlier about election cycles. He comes up against one of the mother of all Republican election cycles in 1980. His luck holds, basically. And he runs against Dan Quayle, I would say a relatively unknown United States congressman. So on second or third district or whatever. Fourth district. Excuse me. Thank you. And the hostage crisis is happening in Iran. There's something that's called the misery index, is where you take inflation and unemployment and you add it together and how much you have. And Carter had given the malaise speech, which he never used the word malaise, but he basically admonished the American people to buck up. And it was a bad time for Democrats all around. And it's a good time for me, but I was 12, but I still remember. What was that election like? How soon did you know you would be running against Dan Quayle? And clearly of the opponents in the first three elections, maybe it would be fair to say Quayle was the least formidable heading in.
I think that's very fair to say myself. We thought for a long time it would be Governor Bowen. And
Miles talks about that in our podcast.
Good about that because we were seeing polling in the state that was showing at that point Bowen and Bayh neck and neck. And I remember Birch saying that if he's there in the state every day and we're running even now, I'm happy to take him on.
Otis Bowen was a very popular two-term, right, ending his second term as governor of Indiana.
And they worked together well, too, by the way, Bayh and Bowen. Once Bowen said he wasn't running, we quickly felt that it would be Quayle. There wasn't anybody else in the delegation that was going to do it. We didn't believe they were going to throw some sacrificial lamb up there. There was going to be a lot of interest in taking him on. And all the markings for a bad election year were already there. If you remember, we had double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment, double-digit interest rates, hostages in Iran, gas lines, an unpopular president. It was kind of tough.
Cold War was really raging.
And every night on TV at the end of the newscast, they would announce how many days the hostages had been held.
America held hostage, right?
That's right. That's right. And Carter had tried the rescue attempt, and it had failed.
I believe that's the only single thing that could have changed that election for us and Carter.
I think that's probably right.
And that succeeded.
That's right. At what point, you know, it's funny, Mitch Daniels is coming on the podcast here in another few months, and we already had Mark Miles on the podcast. Mark Miles, who ran Quayle's campaign in 1980 after having run Hudnut's reelect as mayor in 79. Do you get the sense, looking back, for those of you who were all involved, that there was little to nothing that could have been done to change the outcome of that election?
Yes.
That it's just a wave election and there's just simply nothing you can do in a Republican state in a wave election year.
Yeah, I think looking back, it wasn't.
Birch Bayh ran ahead of the ticket.
Way ahead. He set records over himself. Was it like 400,000 votes?
Carter lost by 440,000 votes. We lost by 160,000 votes.
Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing split in the tickets. So
in a state where most counties use machines with straight ticket voting.
There were people, I think, after the election, there were people who said that the voters of Indiana didn't mean for Birch Bayh to lose. They meant to send him a message.
I remember you saying that. Actually, I remember you saying that right after the election, yeah. And I've quoted that. I agree with you.
At what point did you realize we can't overcome the wave? I mean, was it October, September? No. Or?
It was election day. I mean, we knew things were bad, but it was still possible. The bottom kind of fell out the last few days. We had stopped doing our tracking polling at that point. A lot of people who were continuing that saw the bottom drop out right before the election. The reminders of the year of the hostage, the anniversary was election day.
That's right, November 4th. That's right.
Yeah. I think most of us, I can count for myself, didn't believe we were going to lose. We knew it was tough, but we thought we were going to win. We didn't think Quayle was a great candidate. We knew it was a bad year, but we had faith in we've seen this guy. He's good on his feet.
And the fact that Quayle was, I would imagine, certainly more stealthy than an Otis Bowen candidacy would have been, where he would have had a record for 8 years as governor. Did that hurt as well? just harder to hit him because he hadn't really been involved very long.
Yeah.
That was a terrible year for Democrats. I think Reagan got 489 electoral votes. Hank Carter got 49. You had multiple senators.
12 Democratic senators lost their seats that year.
Double-digit House Democrats lose. What was Senator Bayh like that night and the morning after?
Well, I have to tell you, it's really one of the good memories, because we were feeling pretty lousy, as you might imagine, most of us. I had a 13-year career come crashing down that night. He actually stood before the crowd and said, "You know, I can't feel bad." He said, "I've been given 18 years to do exactly what I want to do, and how many people get that opportunity?" And then he thanked the people of Indiana for giving him the opportunity to practice law. But he literally, and in private, I'm telling you, there was nothing. There was none of the no recriminations, no anger, no great sorrow. Disappointment, sure, but it was really uplifting.
Did he ever consider running for anything ever again?
No. In fact, particularly when Evan started showing his interest in running, Birch strongly felt this is Evan's turn.
How proud, as we wind up here, we have just a few more minutes. Try to put into words, maybe Nancy, you may be the closest one to do it, how proud Birch Bayh was of Evan, who became his own force and is one of the few people. I think there's three or four people in Indiana history who have won four statewide elections, and Evan Bayh is one of them.
Yeah, I think any of us who have been a parent, you know, when your child succeeds, you just can't be prouder. And I know he felt that way too.
Because he won his old seat.
He won his old seat, yeah. And very frankly, I was one who didn't feel Evan was going to run in politics. He had been my roommate in the 80 campaign. I was convinced that was not his thing. So I was kind of surprised when he turned around and started running. But yeah, of course he was proud. It's your son. He's doing what you've been doing.
I just can't imagine what it'd be like to be a United States senator and then have your son win your seat.
It's pretty cool.
I think that's a good word for it.
Very cool.
As we wind up here, I'm going to give each of you just a minute or so to just maybe reflect one last time on the man and the career and his impact both on you and the state. Nancy, go first.
Well, I always have admired him for his political courage. It was just outstanding, and he would march into hell for a heavenly cause. But after he passed away, I reflected on the many kindnesses he extended to just everyone. You know, to go to Richard Lugar's office and to welcome him. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've sent him emails and say, so-and-so's passed away, or, you know, they're in a difficult spot. He would always make time to call, to send a note. And the thing I'm left with now is what an incredibly kind person he always was.
Well, you know, along those lines, I've told this story to a number of friends recently. When my oldest son was 4 years old, he had open heart surgery, and the only non-family member who showed up at the hospital was Birch Bayh. Those kinds of things are hard to fully describe what they mean to you. Look, in my life, I mean, the impact was amazing. I'm proud of the association. I'm proud of what he did with his career. And I had a couple of occasions with him in the room to summarize my feelings, and what I've said was that when I began, he was my hero. He then became my mentor, and later he became my friend, and he's still all three.
Beautiful. Louis?
I will tell you that, and I've said this before, that you know, there's an old saying that no man is a hero to his own valet. Mm-hmm. I saw Birch Bayh up close and personal in some times that weren't like real happy, you know, like, and I never saw him lose his temper. I never saw him be short with a staff member. The relationship between the power structure between a member of Congress and his staff or her staff is vast. I mean, mm-hmm. the labor laws do not apply to staff, congressional staff members, you know. And
no overtime pay.
Yeah, that's right. No overtime pay, and you are completely at the pleasure of the member. And I never saw Birch Bayh be anything but kind and decent to his staff. And all three of us have been in D.C. All three of us, you know, were on congressional staffs. And everybody, all the staff people knew who were the members of Congress who were mean to their staffs. Never Birch Bayh.
Nancy Pappas, Bob Lehmeyer, Louis Mahern join us today to talk about the remarkable career of Senator Birch Bayh. And the only thing I can add in terms of a coda is someone who yanked his kid out of school so that we could go to the Lugar Remembrance Memorial Service together, because I told my son Andrew, I said, you need to be there, was the multiple mentions of and expressions of condolences from the Lugar family and the Lugar Memorial attendees to the Bayh family. Thank all of you for being here today. I'm really very honored.
Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.